This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike DeBusky. More controversy surrounding the Supreme Court, this time after a New York Times story triggered anger over impartiality appearances.
An article referred to that incident, and I said, oh my God, of course that's what it was. It was hanging upside down.
Aya Carlson's neighbor of conservative Justice Samuel Alito talking about how she remembers seeing an upside down American flag flying outside Alito's home back in 2021. An upside down flag is a military symbol of distress that's been co-opted by some Trump supporters who incorrectly believe the 2020 election was stolen. Mercedes-Benz workers in Alabama won't be unionizing anytime soon after workers rejected an effort to do so by 56%. It comes after a month after Volkswagen factory workers in Tennessee voted to join the United Auto Workers. President Biden approved a major disaster declaration for Texas after severe weather killed five in the Houston area. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Federally funded food pantries in Wisconsin have to stop asking for identification in October. State health officials say the aim is to improve access for people who need it most. But some pantry officials wonder how they'll track demographic information or prevent food shortages. Wisconsin Republicans gathering in Appleton this weekend for the state party convention. Democrats are raising a lot more money these days, but state GOP chair Brian Schimming isn't fazed.
Their cost per vote's pretty high. They dropped over $100 million on Ron Johnson and lost. And so I always tell people what's
money doesn't tell the whole story.
Money does not tell the whole story at all.
Schimming speaking with Wisconsin Eye. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
An unsuspecting driver at a gas station in Wisconsin.
Welcome, Paul 15. How you doing?
Great.
Were you wearing your seatbelt today?
I never wear my seatbelt.
We're going to get him. We're going to get him real good.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello, sir. How you doing?
Dollar driver. Yeah, it takes 1 second to strap a seatbelt on. Well, let's do this. Let's do it together. Now, don't that feel better?
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Click it or tick it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways.
And I should have recognized your voice when you were harassing
me. I'm watching you.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to spend a little time today on the farm bill. But before we do, I started thinking today about how do we get to the mess we're in? Look, I've talked about it numerous times on this program over the years. My upbringing, one of meager means. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, a high poverty area. As I've said, we were where they put the socioeconomic ladder on top of. And I've said numerous times, thanks to a lot of the Great Society programs, the War on Poverty programs, I've been able to do okay for myself. The investments that our government made in me has paid back, but it was a good investment. And, I started thinking about, you think about Johnson's Great Society programs and the War on Poverty and all of the things that Johnson was able to get done in 1.5 terms. And you think about the stuff that made lives better, especially for people in low income areas. And Johnson really did focus on poverty, focused on a domestic agenda that was going to make lives better. They were working. I mean, you look at the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964. It created several programs that were supposed to address poverty, like Jobs Corps, VISTA, Community Action Program, Head Start, the Community Action Program. just provided a little bit of resource so you could get some training, support for folks in low-income communities to empower them to address the needs in their community, the ability for them to make change locally. And you saw a lot of this happen. It doesn't happen overnight, but you saw a lot of activity from this. Job Corps, for instance, provided vocational training and job placement for folks who are in those low, you know, high poverty, low wealth areas, and gave them the ability to find the skills and the jobs that gave them opportunities. VISTA, the Volunteers in Service to America program, kind of, a domestic version of the Peace Corps, allowed people, you know, who want to do good work at home, who want to do service for their community, to go into low-income areas and help address poverty, help do some of the things that needed to be done, you know, like childcare, like transportation, you know, things that, you know, weren't being addressed by the wealth class and the private market. Also, Head Start was a big thing that came out of that, giving kids an opportunity early to get into school, get health and nutrition services, get things to low-income kids that would give them at least a start. Because understand, and I talk about this often because I lived it. When you're in these high-poverty communities, you're starting from way back. The other day, we had Randy Weingarten on the show talking about the 10 million books that they've given away and how in those communities, especially the one I grew up in, a book was an opportunity to change the world. None of us had any. So the fact that they're giving away 10 million books is just amazing. But you think about what Johnson did. I mean, you know, passed Medicaid and Medicare. So seniors would have health care through Medicare and through low-income individuals through Medicaid. We made sure there was a safety net for people. Seems reasonable. They passed the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 65, which said, hey, we're going to make sure that there's funding to give kids an opportunity. HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Programs, to get more people from low-income communities to be able to move up a little bit, opportunities to get out of those places. And they were working. And I remember those programs. I remember the lunch programs in the summer, for instance, where kids from our school in our area would line up at the local public school and get a hot lunch. The only hot meal a lot of those kids got for the day. There were programs in the summer to keep people active. There were educational opportunities throughout the year to get kids engaged. And I remember when Ronald Reagan became president, that all stopped because we had to have tax cuts for rich people. I mean, the Economic Recovery Tax Act of 81 was horrible. And I would argue a big part of creating the billionaire class we have today and the massive inequality that we have today, the massive, deep, painful, spiteful cuts to social programs like Medicaid, food stamps, housing assistance, all the things that Johnson had done to help alleviate poverty, to help give people an opportunity to reach out that helping hand and say, we're going to give you a chance. Reagan undid. Because we needed tax cuts for the rich, we needed tax cuts for corporations, and we need phallic-looking things to shoot in the sky. Oh, and that Star Wars thing. But much worse than that, it wasn't just an attack on poor people. Reagan destroyed the middle class. All of his deregulation schemes, and look, he wasn't the only one, but he's the guy who put the pedal to the metal. And what did we end up with? In all those industries that were regulated, you had reasonable wages. You had reasonable wages, raises with those wages that would keep up with inflation. And what did you get after deregulation? Well, massive job losses, wage losses that are just incredible, and an increase in economic insecurity. And I look at myself, I talk about this often. When you look at the freight industry, deregulation destroyed that industry. And Reagan was all on board. Granted, Carter passed it, signed it, but Reagan knew where the gas was. So when it came time to attack labor unions after they fired the Patco workers, sending that shot across the boardroom saying it's open season, what you saw is a weakened labor movement. You saw declining workers' rights. You saw job insecurity. You saw wages falling. You saw benefits being taken away. And oh, by the way, then we saw, hey, you don't need those stinking union pensions. You can have a 401k. And you stop and you think about all of the things that we are struggling with today. You go back to the Reagan era. It was that choice that we made in 1980. It was that choice of, we're going to get the guy who memorized the lines and who told us it was going to be morning in America. Only to, well, steal the coffee, the eggs, the bacon, and well, not for everyone. Some people did really, really, really well. But you think of the massive redistribution of wealth that happened during the Reagan years and the Republican Revolution. Because if you remember, Republicans were all about tax cuts. That was their fetish. Small government, small enough they can drag it into the bathtub and drown it, because we don't want government having policies that make people's lives better. Because what they were able to do masterfully, and this is the part that's interesting, they were able to pit the working middle class, the blue-collar middle class that unions had gotten really good wage jobs. You were able to pit them against the poor people, against me as a kid. You were able to get them to go, well, my children don't get these things. He shouldn't either. Instead of going, hey, how do we all do better? No. It was about crushing these programs. And that's what Reagan did masterfully, which is why he had all these Reagan Democrats running over. We don't want to pay for those poor people. Only to realize that it was them that he was really going after. It was those high-wage jobs that they used to have. So you fast forward to today, you've got Donald Trump who's going, well, see, those poor people are getting stuff you're not getting. And yet his policies are continuing that legacy of Reaganomics. More tax cuts for the rich, more deregulation, more corporate control, and less government of, for, and by we the people. Less government for the people. And we've been trained to believe we can't solve problems anymore. You go to that great society, that war on poverty idea. We can end poverty. And they did a really great job of it. Massive cuts, especially for seniors. It seems that when you spend money on things, when you have a priority to go after something, you can accomplish it. Conversely, when you want to destroy it, as Republicans have done, you end up where we are. And we're at this 1980s moment kind of again. We're in an interesting spot because it's 1980 again. We can make the choice to continue on the path that's going to get us renewable energy, a sane tax code, strong workers' rights, opportunities for education, all of those things that we say we want. Or we can go the other way. You can bring Trump back and we end up with drill, baby, drill. We end up with all kinds of attacks on workers, all kinds of privatization and deregulation schemes, all kinds of the stuff that got us into the mess that we're in currently and that Biden's trying to dig us out of. And for me, I'll tell you, I'm thrilled by the fact that Joe Biden has been doing the job that he's been doing because it's moving us in the right direction. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Abby Malloy is going to be here to share some thoughts on the farm bill that, well, maybe we'll see. We'll see what comes of it. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, can't wait to see what's coming out of the farm bill. Both the House and the Senate are coming out with their bills. And look, I can pretty much guarantee the House bill is going to be garbage. The Senate bill might be good. There could be some good things in there, at least I hope. Not certainly what I would want to see in it. But we'll see. We'll see. Maybe Mike Johnson, maybe he'll surprise me. Maybe they'll be, we want to feed children. We don't want to punish poor people. Maybe that's going to be there. I'm here to share some thoughts on, well, what might we expect? I've asked Abby Malloy to come talk with us. She's the Director of Health, Environmental, and Nutrition Policy at First Focus on Children. Abby, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. Excited to be here.
So let's talk about this farm bill because, for me, this is the kind of stuff that, these are moral documents in my view. This tells me where your priorities are, tells me what you believe, tells me what your faith is. What do we expect in these? What do we see?
Sure. So in the House version, like you said, we're not expecting to see much good. I think folks are really taking a stab at attempting to say they like kids by, fully funding SNAP, which is of course mandatory, but then taking cracks at altering things like eligibility, enrollment, the actual amount of the benefits. And that's where we're going to see people trying to make drastic cuts in the House, particularly. In the Senate, much better off so far. We're looking at stuff like helping college students enroll in SNAP, getting Puerto Rico up to speed with America's SNAP, the 50 continuous states SNAP benefits, which is excellent. And so that's where we're seeing this kind of hard line. But I think you're 100% right. I think the House version is just egregious and absolutely takes food right out of kids' mouths.
No, and look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, during the 70s. So you still had some of Johnson's Great Society programs. I remember you used to line up at Peerdus Elementary School in the summertime for a hot lunch, probably for most of those kids, the only hot meal they were going to have. I also remember Ronald Reagan coming into office and destroying all of that. So I did see as a kid growing up, good policy helping people to make ends meet, and then, well, bad policy that punished poor people. So for me, maybe I'm a little jaded, but I'm kind of expecting a little bit of this this time around.
Unfortunately, I think in the House proposal, you're 100% right. So what they're particularly going after this time is what's called the Thrifty Food Plan. And that's basically a market basket of kind of a standard American diet and what folks would typically purchase at the grocery store that's still frugal and cost effective. But that determines the SNAP benefits. And currently this market basket is made up of things like produce, dark leafy greens, poultry, all sorts of healthy stuff that helps kids grow. But it wasn't always that way.
No.
Prior to 2021, it was actually only adjusted for inflation. And so just the amount of food that was in the package just kept going up. So we ended up with things like 25 pounds of milk, 12 pounds of potatoes, 5 pounds of orange juice for a family of four for a week. And that's how the benefits were calculated. And so what this proposal aims to do is actually eliminate our ability to make any updates or changes to this market basket outside of inflation or food price changes. And so as we look at dietary science and nutritional science, we're going to get drastically out of step as we learn more about what kids need to eat to grow.
No, look, as I said, where I grew up as a kid, our entire neighborhood was on the welfare diet. Anything with a noodle in it, that was dinner for that night. Eggs and noodles, spaghetti and noodles, you name it. My mother figured out how to make it with a noodle because that's what we could afford. And I look at a lot of this stuff that we're you know forcing on poor people, and it's not the most nutritious, and it's probably the worst for us, which is why we do have a lot of certain ailments, especially for low income folks. So for me, this is an opportunity to use good legislation, to use good policy to make lives better, and oh, maybe save some healthcare costs down the road as well.
No, you're 100% right. It's really egregious what folks are trying to do here. I think a robust diet is our best healthcare. Food is your medicine. And so for the House to say, actually, let's get kids away from what they need to eat. Let's just get calories into kids without taking account into account the nutritional quality of those calories is exactly why we have these issues. When you look at food insecurity, a lot of the times kids actually have enough calories. It's pretty nuanced. But when we look at the amount of nutrients that they're getting every day, that's where we're seeing the lack. And that's why when people look at kids who are struggling with obesity, they go, well, we've got a country full of excess. Parents just don't say no, all this kind of crazy stuff. When in reality, it's because their kids can only afford to eat noodles. They can only afford to eat chips. That's the stuff that's low in nutrients and also low in cost.
Yeah.
And that's what we're forcing our kids to eat.
No, for me, you know, I look at this, and this is one of those situations where I know there are people out there going, well, why should we give poor people this wonderful diet when people who are working and you know, my family can't get that kind of stuff? You know, for me, this is an opportunity to just not help low-income folks, but to help people who are struggling. I don't know. Feeding people seems pretty simple in my view, but with the cost of inflation going up and food prices going up, this seems like an opportunity to maybe, I don't know, use good policy to actually help people make lives a little bit better.
Well, you'd hope, right? I mean, I think that's exactly what the Senate bill aims to do, too. It aims to expand that eligibility. So now we're looking at folks like veterans who can access more nutritious foods, more nutritional assistance programs. We're looking at college students, like I mentioned before, Puerto Rico. We're just expanding who can access this program. And this program is absolutely helpful, and everyone deserves to eat good, nutritious food. Like you said, you'd think that kind of be a given, but that's not what we're looking at right now. But yeah, the Senate bill helps us get a little bit closer to that.
Yeah, I've seen some interesting numbers recently on the people who are using food stamps today and the people who need assistance. And overwhelmingly, the people work. I mean, this is the weird part. We have this image in our head that, you know, people on food stamps, well, they're just lazy and shiftless. That's what we've been sold. That's been the narrative since Reagan forward, the idea of the welfare queen sitting around, you know, eating steak, drinking Dom Perignon on our dime while we're working, when the reality is, just like the homeless population, these are folks who have jobs. They just don't pay enough to put food on the table and in most poor cases, a roof over their heads.
No, you're 100% right. And that's what's really so upsetting about the whole situation. You can be working 40 hours a week and you can still need nutritional assistance. You can work a full-time job. You can have kids. You can be a single mom with three kids working all day long and still not have enough to feed your family, which is just absolutely heartbreaking. And so what we're looking at here is an opportunity to kind of bridge that gap. But no, you're 100% right. It's absolutely just nefarious.
No, and this has been this way for a very long time. And, you know, as where my mind goes, like I said earlier, you know, I remember the, you know, the Johnson Great Society programs that helped people, the idea that we were going to fight poverty and we were going to win the war on poverty. And then you had Reagan come in who just eviscerated those programs. And look, I saw the very real consequences of people going hungry. And in the wealthiest country in the history of humanity at its wealthiest moment, I don't know, call me strange, I don't think children should go to bed hungry.
You know what? I'm right there with you, funnily enough, that two people happen to share that opinion. I would imagine there's a lot more Americans that tend to agree with us. But reality is, it's just not where the House is, which is really disheartening and really shocking. And I think you nailed it before. The idea of the welfare queen is just so pervasive for no real reason other than just racism and discrimination. And we're kind of stuck with that. So these programs offer us a way to actually kind of mend our thinking around that. When we actually look at the data, the more likely or children who are on these nutrition assistance programs are actually more likely to earn more as adults, and they're less likely to be on these government programs. So they're really just meant to be a bridge. They're for people who are in between jobs. At times they've gotten laid off, now they need a little bit of assistance. Most people actually work the year before or after, or even during their time on staff. And so that's what it's really meant to be.
No, look, I look at myself. You know, my mother was a single mother in the 70s. The reality is, during that period, single mothers were always the last one hired, first one fired. She was in and out of jobs all the time. We were on and off welfare all the time. It was not a good existence, but we made it through. And the meager investments that our policymakers made in me through food assistance and rent assistance and a public education and all of those things have paid them dividends, because I have paid, my share of taxes back, and in multiples, as opposed to where had you not done that, what road would someone take in the event that they don't get that helping hand? Do we then have more people who don't finish school, who don't have opportunities, who end up in jail, who end up doing who knows what? So for me, these kind of investments, this isn't just, you know, good morality and good Christian thought or good religious thought. It's an investment in the future and ensuring that we have people who are, I don't know, functional.
No, you're 100% right. I mean, imagine being a kid in school and you're trying to learn how to multiply, do your times tables, and your stomach is grumbling because all your parents could afford to feed you was maybe like a little breakfast biscuit. It's just straight carbohydrates, just potatoes. That's not going to sustain you. And then it's so much harder for these kids to do well in school. They end up with behavioral problems, higher rates of mental illness, because how do you focus when you just don't even have enough to eat? And what's difficult too is that the parents are put in such a hard position. And especially prior to the Thrifty Food Plan updates, they were actually expected that they would have 13 hours a week to prepare meals for their kids, which meant that they had to only purchase dry beans because they can't have a canned bean. They've got to now spend hours soaking their beans to provide for their children. And this reality just doesn't set people up for success. It's too much work for a small child to overcome hunger as they're trying to learn. It's too much work to ask parents not to buy prepaid or pre-prepared foods because they are supposed to now slave and cook after they've worked maybe two jobs to try and feed their kids just to get them enough nutrients.
No, you said it's hard on the parents. And, you know, I say this all the time. You know, one of the things that makes me the chronic workaholic that I am is, you know, I never wanted to be in a situation where my mother was in, where she had to look into my eyes and know that I was hungry and know there was nothing she could do. I don't wish that on any parent. I can't imagine how horrible that the feeling must be. And I don't think anyone should ever have to feel that. Again, I go back to the wealthiest country in the history of humanity at its wealthiest moment. We can and should do better.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, at the end of the day, nutritional deficiency in America is absolutely a policy choice. And we're looking at policies that have the opportunity to help kids grow, help kids learn, help kids become really functional adults. I mean, it's just so intrinsically linked to their health, their diet early in childhood.
Yeah.
And we have an opportunity to fix it, and we've just got to take it.
So what do we do from here? I mean, you know, here's the weird thing. You know, when you and I have just had one of the most agreeable conversations probably going to ever have. And I have these conversations whenever I talk about this issue face to face with anyone, red hat, blue hat, no hat, pink hat, doesn't matter. Everyone seems to universally agree we should be feeding the children. But yet we've got elected leaders that doesn't seem to get filter up to them. How do we make this the issue? How do we take and move this forward?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing we can do is talk to your representatives. It's tricky because there's a lot of stuff in the Farm Bill, as much as it's mostly focused on nutrition. There's a lot of different pieces in there that are kind of competing for attention. And so what we need is folks in your district to call your representative, call your senator and say, hey, I'm not okay with the Thrifty Food Plan being cut. I know people in our community, your constituents who are hungry, your children that you're supposed to be elected to take care of, are hungry. So what we need is expanded eligibility. We need a strong thrifty food plan, and we need those updates, and we need to continue to invest in our kids to help them grow.
There you go. And you don't have to weigh in on this, but the reality is one of the political parties on this issue has to go, and the first thing you do is start voting them out, because they've shown us, and a couple in the other party as well, the Republicans have shown us that they don't seem to really care about children. Think about the child tax credit that cut child poverty in half, that they forced to expire, and then we doubled childhood poverty in one of the most cruel ways possible. But for me, it comes back to which lever you pull. It is that simple. But Abby, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great having you on. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again really soon.
Thank you, Reg. It was such a pleasure. I really appreciate all you're doing for kids. Keep up the good fight.
Outstanding. Abby Malloy, Director of Health, Environmental, and Nutrition Policy at First Focus on Children. Want to hear your thoughts. You got any stories from when you were a kid? Do you remember the Johnson Great Society programs? Do you remember the optimism, the hope that maybe we could end poverty? We don't think about it. We don't think like that anymore, but do you remember it? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mild tonight, maybe a stray storm, otherwise partly cloudy, lows low 60s. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, warm again with highs in the mid-80s. Slight storm chance Sunday, high upper 70s. More showers and thunderstorms to start next week on Monday and Tuesday, and cooler. It's 71 right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
So I have super parallel parking skills. And on the east side where I live, I will often sit on my front porch and like a play-by-play call as if it was a sport. Parallel parking to me is a sport. I'm the Stephen A. Smith of parallel parking. That should go on a t-shirt.
We'll get you one made.
Oh my gosh.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some salacious stories coming out of Congress. Evidently, a Georgia Republican has filed for divorce from what the Daily Mail called a glamorous oncologist after seven children. Rich McCormick, Republican from Georgia, a good God-fearing Christian type too, you know, seven kids, go forth, be fruitful, good family values guy. Evidently, it's been revealed, according to the Daily Mail, that he's been caressing a colleague on the House floor. Wife not happy. And so after 12 years of marriage and less than 2 years into his congressional career, McCormick filed for divorce. Now, what I find interesting is that they both got mutual restraining orders. And I would guess that, she doesn't want him anywhere near the seven children. Now, when the divorce is coming, I gotta wonder, is this the kind of family values that they need to be pushing? Now, the story does say that according to Republicans, they have seen McCormick and Republican representative from Texas, Beth Van Duen, doing some stuff under the table. Oh, they were holding hands. He would grab the small of her back during House votes. It's like love on the floor. I mean, they're not doing anything else. Might as well go there. And here to share some thoughts on As the Congress Turns, I've asked our good friend, Raw Story reporter Sarah Burris, to join us. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
You know, back in my day, they kept that stuff behind closed doors in their offices where it should be.
In the cloakroom, at least.
Right? Not on the floor. Come on. They're C-SPAN. People are watching that stuff.
Well, you could hide from the C-SPAN cameras. And maybe that was the intrigue. Maybe, you know, after seven kids, you know, you get a little bored.
Here's my question. And I know that you had a more startling observation. do the math on 7 kids in 12 years. I haven't checked to see like what the situation is there, but she's an oncologist and there are 7 kids in 12 years. Like that's, there's got to be some multiples going on there, or I feel very sorry for that woman.
Yeah, no, someone needs to have a conversation with them about,
or some fostering or something.
But you know, again, am I surprised? And I normally don't talk about this stuff, but it was kind of funny that they were, you know, on the house floor, they're holding hands under the table. It's so sophomoric. I mean, and so ridiculous, especially from the folks who tell us that they believe in family values.
Hey, as long as she's not going full Bobert, I'm good.
Okay.
Right. I'm fine with that.
All right, well, let's move on. The trial, the big trial dominated news. What's interesting to me is there are a number of people going, you know, why doesn't Joe Biden get out in front of the camera and talk about the real issues? And you go, no one cares. Everything's focused on this trial. All of the oxygen has been pulled out of everything because of this trial.
We got the news this week that Jimmy Carter is not doing well, and it probably will be soon that we lose him. And that was a story for 5 minutes. And then we've been back to the Trump trial. And it's like, holy crap, guys. It's Jimmy Carter. Come on. But this has been, so it's been Michael Cohen all week, right? And the defense part of it was all fine and dandy. When they went to the cross on Tuesday and Thursday, it was like watching someone step on a rake over and over again, right? It was like bonk, 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 right? And I feel like the second day was at least a little bit better than the first. The first was just an embarrassment. The second day, I swear, he spent probably 4.5 hours just asking Michael Cohen to talk about the times that he lied. And it's just like, dude, we get it already. Like, this is stuff that the prosecutors brought up in their direct because, you know, it's something that they knew that the defense was going to have to deal with, right? Well, I mean, I'm not sure you need to spend 5 hours on something like this. And, I mean, apparently the jury was, you know, just as noticeably annoyed as everybody else was. The one thing that came out of it Thursday afternoon, and this is the idea of do no harm. Donald Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, did a little bit of harm here. And he started asking Cohen about his statement to Congress. And one of the things that Cohen says in his statement to Congress is that they were doing the Trump Tower Moscow deal, but don't worry, we only talked about it like, you know, 3 times or so, and it wasn't during the campaign. But it turns out they actually were talking about it during the campaign, and they talked about it 10 times. What Blanche asked about was the 2-page document. This wasn't just like something that Michael Cohen got up and then said something in front of Congress and, you know, lied about it. He lied about it in a 2-page document. And what Michael Cohen said is, well, that document was decided on based on the joint counsels and the lawyers for the president of the United States, which we didn't know. I mean, Michael Cohen had been saying, you know, I lied for the president. We didn't know that there was a conspiracy of people working for Donald Trump to craft a false 2-page document that they submitted to Congress that was a lie.
Wow.
That was a whole new bombshell. And it was something where everyone was like, wait, what? Wait, go back? Because it was just sort of in passing, you know, and everyone was like, oh, that was bad. That was really bad.
Yeah, but I thought there were no dealings in Moscow. He's never had any dealings, never wanted any dealings. There was never any discussion of dealings. I seem to be very clear that there was nothing.
Lies. All lies. All
Shocker.
Evidence to the contrary.
So let me ask you this, though. I mean, in watching the trial and watching, you know, Cohen, because look, the guy's a serial liar, and I'm gonna—I believe that as well, because he was Trump's fixer. It's his job to be that kind of bottom feeder. Do you think the jury is going to see that, as you said, that the defense beleaguered the point? Do you think that comes, or do you think they think kind of as I do? The guy's got, he's kind of clearing his soul at this moment. He's got nothing left to lose. Maybe now he's found some honesty, and maybe trying to clear the soul. I don't know. Any thoughts?
It's that last part that you said that I think is important. He has nothing left to lose. And what was different in all of the other cases where he lied is he was still covering up for Donald Trump. He was still trying to figure out a plea deal. He was still trying, like, all of these things where he was, trying to stay out of prison, and still trying to be as true to Donald Trump as he could until Donald Trump ultimately threw him under the bus.
Yeah.
At this point, he's already been to jail. Like, he's got nothing else. He's lost his law license. He's lost his taxi medallion business. He's lost everything. And so there is nothing left to lose here. And so there's no point, in lying.
Yeah, I got to tell you, though, I look at Cohen, and he, for me, should be the cautionary tale for anyone Trump approaches. Anyone that would even consider working for Donald Trump, you should go look at Michael Cohen.
I would say Michael Cohen and maybe Mike Pence.
Well,
because at the very least, he never tried to kill Michael Cohen that we know of.
True. But Mike Pence isn't, broken, going to jail and all of that stuff, and true, completely thrown under the bus. Like a lot of people. I mean, think about all the people who are going to go broke with legal fees trying to keep themselves out of prison because of this guy. It's remarkable. As I understand, the jury could get this as early as next week.
Yes, that's going to be my birthday present from the jury. Okay. I thought it was very nice of them to consider that as a gift for me.
I'm going to be honest with you. I haven't watched 5 minutes of the trial.
So, I mean, the big part of it is you can't actually watch the trial unless you're there.
No, I mean, I haven't watched anything of it. I haven't paid attention to it. I actually, to be honest, and this is going to be horrible, I honestly don't care. I'm in this point where the he's guilty in my view. I'm sure, I've heard, this stuff for a while. But it's not going to matter, because it's not going to change people. I don't believe it's going to change people's thoughts. I think people are dug in. And I don't think if he's found guilty, it's going to make anybody run from him. I think it may solidify the base even further because he's being, he's being persecuted. So I haven't given myself the permission to waste my time watching it.
I know. You know that I'm just the world's biggest nerd.
I know you are. That's why I come to you for what, tell me what's going on.
So, I mean, it's like politics and law, and we're going to bring them both together. And I mean,
oh my gosh,
cake and pie, everything Woo! Would just be even better. So a little bit of champagne and
there you
everything
go.
Is rocking on. But the thing I think that that has come out of this is, I think that we have seen a lot of people who recognize that a jury trial is something different. And in this case, Trump has started trashing the jury at the second that they were chosen. He tried to trash the jury before they were chosen by saying, the pool of people they're going to get out of this is ridiculous. So I think people understand that when you have a jury of your peers, that they take it more seriously. And, there have just been so many missteps by Trump's lawyers who, frankly, after 30 years practicing, should know better.
You would think.
And
you would think.
Right.
I got to move along. Because I got to get your thoughts on the debate. Evidently, there's going to be debate. There's going to be a debate. Or I don't think there's ever going to be a debate, but
I know, right? That's the part that I was like,
there might be a debate. It's scheduled. It's on someone's calendar, not mine yet. But what do you think? Especially now that Trump has come out and said that he'd be happy to, he wouldn't mind if RFK Jr. was in the fray.
What's interesting is Trump has been trying to make a press thing out of this, or try and poke Biden with this. For like, I guess a weekend, they bought like an extra podium to leave it empty beside him at rallies. But the problem is in the meantime, whenever he said, Biden's never going to debate me, he's never going to debate me, Biden was crafting the rules and the proposal that he wanted to submit to Trump. And Trump basically just immediately said, yeah, because Biden was starting to make fun of him, be like, you know, make my day, pal. I'm here. I hear you're off on Wednesdays, which I thought was absolutely the best trolling I have seen from this president yet.
Oh, that's
and
good.
And so I, you know, they are thankfully going to have it a lot earlier than October, because it turns out people vote early. Who knew? Who knew? This isn't sanctioned by the Presidential Debate Commission, which may, given how out of touch they are, they may just be completely obsolete at this point. It's going to be on CNN. What I think they will probably miss is, I think the thing's only going to be like an hour or two long.
Right.
Why? Honestly, like this will be one of the biggest events on television for cable news and probably for CNN all year. So why not take it into like 4 hours? I get it. Like presidents have to pee, especially these guys, yeah. Right? You're that old, but take a long break, let them pause, go to the bathroom, have some water, and then have a legitimate conversation about issues. Because I think once you get all of the same Trump, you know, ragegasms out and have legitimate conversations about everything, people will see there's all hat, no cattle.
Yeah. No, I don't think Trump, I think he's already given himself kind of a way out. I don't think he's going to do it for a bunch of reasons, because I don't think he's there. I think if you've watched some of his speeches, like the other day, what was that thing about Hannibal Lecter was a wonderful guy? I'm going to have
that,
someone.
And then on Saturday in New Jersey, he said he saw O.J. Simpson in the crowd. And it's like, who's going to tell him that O.J.'s dead?
No, it's not even that. You know what his mind, you know what he was thinking.
Is it just like all black people look the same?
That's what he was thinking.
Yeah.
Hey, there's OJ. No, it's but I've been watching his speeches, and the more that he speaks, the crazier he gets. So you're right. The four hour format would be just Biden going, go ahead.
Yeah.
Have the floor.
The rope to hang himself.
Have the floor.
And I think after what we have been through over the last several years, especially with Donald Trump, we deserve to have, as Americans, we deserve to have a substantial, substantive conversation about actual policy issues.
Yeah,
about
I don't
everything,
think people
foreign
really,
policy and domestic,
do
everything.
Think, do you think people care about that?
I think more people care about it than, I think people care about their specific issue.
Yeah.
And so if the whole debate is on, you know, one or two issues, then people are like, well, this is a waste of my time. But if you cover everything, like at the very least, touch everything, at the very least, you're communicating to every single voter.
We'll see. I'm looking forward to the possibility. I think it's like 20% chance.
You know, one of the rules is that they're going to cut the microphones off. And so my theory is that Trump's going to be like, they're going to try and stifle my free speech. I don't know why he's Southern all of a sudden. But they're violating my First Amendment rights. And so I'm not going to do it.
No,
and
see,
I think that's what it is.
Where my thought is because I had this conversation right when I found out about that. I said, it's not going to matter because you could turn off his mic. You can't shut his mouth. And
yeah.
As long as Biden is in the room, you can knock him off. Because if you look at what Sean Hannity does, if you watch Hannity never lets somebody that he disagree with finish a thought.
Right.
He never lets them get to the thought. He always interrupts. He always butts in. He always tries to change their thought process. And I see Trump doing that to him, regardless if the mic's on or not. So I would like to go, hey, how about we just put him in glass booths?
That's what I thought for a long time. Like one of those old game shows from like the 50s. Yeah, put him in the glass booth.
Let him
zoom. Lincoln Douglas style and make them fight over the microphone, which you know would end up in like a push-up contest or something amazing like that. The other thing is I would love for them to start asking questions off the citizenship exam.
Yeah.
You know, just like throw some out. Like, do you know what the three branches of government are?
I'm in favor of that. No, someone asked me, well, you think we should let immigrants vote? We should make them do the citizens test. I go, they do the citizens test. That's how they become citizens. But how about you? How about we ask you the citizenship question before you get to vote? Now, again, I'm against, honestly, again, you make that to the point to where you're going to make it so difficult nobody can vote. I get that. But, you know, it is enticing. It is enticing. Finally, got to get your thought on impeachment has been talked about again.
So Thursday night, they're still talking about impeachment. And after, I guess, a bunch of them went to New York to spend the day with Trump. They jumped back on the train to get back as soon as possible for an 8 p.m. markup of the impeachment of Merrick Garland. And now they're talking about they want to put the impeachment of Biden on the calendar. And in the background of one of the Democrats complaining about it, Scott Perry is screaming, "We'll have the evidence by then," or something to that effect. And it's just like, oh, honey.
That's no, really the exact quote was, "We just need the evidence."
I'm embarrassed for him.
Oh, come on. Scott, pardon me, Perry. There's no shame there. Embarrassed for him because he's not embarrassed.
I'm embarrassed for his district.
And this is where I live. So the hope is that the woman running against him, hope people get out for him. But the thing that gets me is, and I love what Jared Moskowitz did, saying, look, when do we want to put it on the calendar? How about this month? How about this month? Let's get it done, because they keep threatening this impeachment. They keep dangling it out there, and they know there's nothing. There's no there. Yeah. So it's just a matter of you got to keep feeding the base the red meat so that they'll continue to be, well, we're going to get Biden. No, you're not.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be a problem for them too. If they don't schedule it by the election, you're going to have a lot of MAGA people being like, what's the point of you?
No,
you couldn't even do this and you have control.
No, we'll see. But I'm waiting for it because I'm looking for, they're not doing anything else. This would at least be an act of Congress. They would actually do something. There you go. But Sarah, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time.
Thank you. Have a nice weekend.
Yeah, you as well. Our good friend Sarah Burris. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day the U.S. Supreme Court handed down their decision in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. In the unanimous decision, the court declared that racial segregation in public education was illegal. The case was filed for Linda Brown, a student who had been denied enrollment in her local elementary school because she was black. The court's decision overturned the concept of separate but equal. This legal basis for discrimination and segregation had been established by the Supreme Court earlier in their 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. The Brown decision overturned nearly six decades of legally sanctioned racism. The American Federation of Teachers filed an amicus brief, or friend of the court brief, in support of the Brown family. The union's motion stated, quote, "The American Federation of Teachers, whose 60,000 classroom teacher members represent the group which does the actual work of teaching the nation's children, is committed to a practice of complete equality between teachers and children of every race. This principle is written indelibly in its constitution and bylaws." In addition, the United Federation of Teachers of New York City also filed a brief with the court in support of Brown. Even after the court's decision, school desegregation did not come easy. Mobs of angry white Southerners showed up at schools to protest the admission of black students. In 1957, the National Guard had to protect nine black students attempting to enroll in school in Little Rock, Arkansas. The United Teachers Union led the American Federation of Teachers to expel Southern Union locals that refused to abide by the desegregation decision. The Brown decision helped to launch the civil rights movement. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter @laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I thank Christine from Oregon, who sent me a bumper sticker. Evidently, she was listening to the show the other day. I guess this has been a couple of weeks ago. And she said to me, she goes, "You know, did you say this?" And I said, "Yeah, that sounds like me." So she went and she had bumper stickers made up that had a quote from me on it. This is the kind of cool stuff that I love doing this program. But, you know, the bumper sticker's right. The glutton class feeds us distraction while it steals our future. And I go back to where I started today's program. You stop and you think about all of the wealth that has been accumulated by the handful at the top. All of the wealth that we've given them under the guise that they know what to do with it, they're going to grow it, and it's going to make everybody better off. You know, the Jeff Bezoses of the world saying, you know, he's going to make Amazon the best company to work for in the world ever. Only to find out highest injury rates, enormous rates of poverty and needing of social programs to get by. And again, this comes back down to who do we vote for? Who are we electing? Who are we putting into the positions of power? And, you know, I got to tell you, as we speak, my Teamster brothers and sisters across the country are going to their union meetings and casting their ballot for endorsement in this upcoming election. And I got to tell you, and this is where, and I've gotten into a lot of trouble about this. You know, it seems the Teamsters president is not happy with me having an opinion on this or disagreeing with him on any level, and has been doing his foolhardy best to attack the program. But I'm still going to stand by the fact that leadership is what we saw out of Sean Fain. Leadership is, sorry, I am not meeting with Donald Trump. He is the problem. Leadership is going, hey, we know what he did. We know what the rerun and the reboot is going to look like. And it's going to look worse than the first one, because no sequel is ever better. At least I don't think, well, maybe The Godfather 2. But, you know, this is where I reach out to my Teamster brothers and sisters and say, go to your local meetings, cast your ballot, reward Joe Biden for the work that he has done for our unions and for working people in this country. Yeah, I get it. I hear all of the noise. I hear all of the talk. I hear all of the inflation's killing us. You know what? We can solve that with smart policies. What I haven't heard is anything coming from the Trump people. There's this blind faith belief that when Trump comes in, it's going to be just like it was. When the reality is no, it's not. They have no agenda other than retribution and payback. They have no path to rebuilding the middle class, to rebuilding a prosperous working class. They've got no plan. The way forward through this is empowering workers. The way forward in this is through policy that gives people the opportunity to collectively bargain. The only way the wealth class of this country shares is if they have to. There's no benevolent dictator going, here, I bestow all of these wonderful things on you just out of the goodness of my heart. It's one of those things that has to be demanded. And I think we are waking up to that. I think coming out of the pandemic, we're waking up to it. But I look at where we are, especially in my union. It seems almost rudderless. And I know democracy in the workplace. I get that. And I'm on board with it. But some decisions are, it's important to have leadership. And the reason that people vote for leadership is to ensure that, you know, we get what we need, and that the leadership that we have hopefully steers us in the right direction, hopefully takes us down the right path and moves us in a way that, I hate to say it, but protects us from ourselves sometimes. Now, it's going to be interesting to see where this vote goes. I'm curious, like everyone else. I will be casting my ballot this weekend. But brothers and sisters, now is the time to get out there, speak while, and defend. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you've got any thoughts on this, you missed any portion of the program, grab the podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, freespeech.org for the video of the show and all of that. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.